Well, welcome to the Michiana Adventist Forum. Glad to have you here today for our program on the millennial generation in the Adventist Church. We'll be led by Dr. Meredith Jones Gray, and she has, as you can see, a multidisciplinary panel from the Andrews community that will be chiming in. And then afterwards, we'll have a time for discussion, and Gary Gray will have the roaming mic, and you can make comments, and I'm glad to see we have some real live millennials here who can do some fact checking and make sure that there aren't too many pieces of misinformation that are left unrefuted. As we begin our time together, Gary Smith is going to offer a word of prayer.
Shall we pray? Dear Father, we ask for your blessings on this meeting this afternoon, especially as we talk about such a very important subject for this church and for this university. We ask for your blessings in Jesus' name. Amen.
Well, for, as you're aware, probably millennials have been defined in various ways. In my simple-minded approach, I say it's kind of somebody that was born in the 80s or 90s. I'm sure we'll hear a little more refined definition as time goes on. Just to get the juices for you non-millennials in the audience flowing, I pulled together a few quotations by millennials, about millennials, that have been applied to millennials. Millennials don't just want to read the news anymore. They want to know what they can do about it. Youth is not a time of life, it's a state of mind. We're dealing with the best educated generation in history, but they've got a brain dressed up with nowhere to go. That actually was originally a Timothy Leary quote from Rolling Stones back in the 80s, applied to an earlier generation, but it's been repurposed and applied to the millennials more recently. Embrace the mess. Honor your father and mother, because you might have to live in their basement. Two roads diverged in a wood, and I took the one less tweeted about. And then life is what happens while you're looking at your smartphone. Well, our next forum meeting is on Sabbath afternoon, March 28. And we'll be hearing from Dr. Manuela Costi-Yagley. She is the director of the European Value Genesis Study, which is researching the attitudes and so on of Adventist youth in Europe. And then on April 11, Deborah Brees, a local attorney who practices family law, will be speaking to us about alternative dispute resolution and collaborative approaches to conflict resolution. And just remind you, there's a sign-up sheet in the back if you're not getting email notices of the meetings and would like to. Give us your name and email address. We'd be glad to add you to the list. And we appreciate particularly this week all the extra work that Jim Harris and Daryl have been doing to make the audio-video stuff come together for our meeting. Well, as I mentioned, today's discussion deals with millennial generation, the Adventist Church. Dr. Meredith Jones Gray is coordinating the discussion. She's a parent, a teacher, and chair of the English department here at Andrews. Our other panel members in alphabetic order are Nancy Carbonell, who is coordinator of the Clinical Mental Health Counseling Program and is an associate professor of graduate psychology and counseling at Andrews. Jan Sigvarsten is adjuvant professor of Old Testament at the SDA Theological Seminary, and he's co-author of the study Beyond Beliefs, Part 1. This is a book reporting on a project investigating the knowledge of Seventh-day Adventist young adults in regard to the 28 fundamental beliefs and their attitudes toward them. His wife, Leanne, is a researcher and a project manager of the Beyond Beliefs research team. She's co-author of the book I mentioned. She's also author of the book, Religious Verbal Fluidity, What Nice Christian Folk Really Think. She holds bachelor, postgraduate, and master's qualifications in psychology and counseling, and is currently concluding PhD studies in education, and had a counseling practice specializing in the treatment of young adults. And she's doing double duty today because her scheduled babysitter decided to stay in Florida for a few extra days. So we have two premillennials in the back, and she'll be contributing with the wireless mic while she's also taking care of the kids. Kurt Vanderwall is professor and chairman of the social work department here at Andrews. He's the parent of three millennials, none of whom could be coerced into participating on the panel. So we'll have to settle for the father, but he's pretty insightful and articulate, so I think he'll do fine. And then, besides her other qualifications, Alisa Williams is a real live millennial. She's educated in psychology. She has a background in writing in the advertising industry and is currently the annual giving coordinator here at Andrews in the Office of Development. She also serves as Spectrum spirituality editor. And if you follow the Spectrum website, you may have read some of her blogs dealing with topics related to millennials and Adventism. So I probably said more than I should. I will turn it over to Meredith and the panel.
Thank you. Good afternoon. You're probably wondering why a teacher of English is leading out in this forum today with a topic that so clearly appears to be a sociological topic, perhaps a psychological topic, maybe theological, but certainly not literary. So let me tell you a little bit about how I got here. In the Department of English, we teach a course called English 215, English Composition. It's the second section of composition, in which we concentrate on source-based academic writing. And each of us chooses a broad theme or topic around which we base our reading models and our assignments. Very broad themes such as work, for instance, or food, or nature. And a couple of years ago, I saw an interview on the PBS NewsHour with the two authors of this book, Millennial Momentum, Morley Winograd and Michael Hayes. It was published in 2011. And they're both communication specialists. They're especially interested in the part that the millennial generation is playing in changing the political climate of the United States. But in Millennial Momentum, they conduct a wide-ranging analysis of the formation of the millennial generation and their attitudes, values, and lifestyles. Well, after listening to this interview, I thought, ha, I have a new theme for 215, the millennial generation. And so I read the book, revised my course, and I've taught this topic now three times with my students in 2013 and 2014. It seems to have energized my students. They're very interested in the topic, and they've done excellent research on the topic. And it's been certainly very educational for me. And as a parent and an educator and a citizen, what I've learned from these discussions with my students and the research that they've done has only increased my affection for and enthusiasm for, but also concern for, the millennials that I know and love, as well as the generation at large. As a church member, I've become convinced that we as a church community have to be paying close attention and talking to and listening to this generation, because these are the young adults who are emerging and will be the core of our church in the future. So we're going to be looking today at who the millennial generation are and why they're so important to all of us. And my role is really more of a convener and moderator, trying to bring people together from different perspectives to join in this conversation. So I'm going to spend a few minutes here at the beginning trying to give a general definition of the millennial generation and sharing some of the information that my students gathered as they begin their research with me. And then I've been very fortunate to persuade some people who know more than I do to join in this conversation about millennials in general and within the Adventist Church in particular. And Dr. Robertson's already introduced them to you. I may say a few more things about them. Our goal is not to offer a lot of answers, but to start a conversation and raise questions that we should be asking about our relationship with the millennials and as individuals and as a church community. And then, of course, we'd like you to join in at the end with our discussion. So, thank you. All right, before I begin, I'd like to express my gratitude to all of my millennial students, and particularly to those who take 215 from me and have contributed to what I know about this topic. Special thanks to Melody Rochman, who helped me prepare this presentation, and for her insightful and articulate observations about her generation. And then to the particular millennial in my life and Gary's life, Jeremy, with whom we've spent long hours in discussion about this topic. So, who are the millennials? Art is not far off in saying that he thinks, well, they're the ones born during the 1980s and 1990s. And that's roughly correct. Numbers vary a little bit on who you ask, but generally, 1982 to 2003 are the brackets for this generation, so the last generation born within the 20th century. Pew Research Center defines it as 1981 to 2000, so you can see a little bit of flexibility there. But this puts millennials roughly in the ages of 12 to 33 this year. It's very convenient in my family. I have a nephew who's 32, a son who's, he's about to be 32, a son who's about to be 22, and a nephew who's 12. So I've got my markers right in place, and very helpful. Most millennials are the children of baby boomers and Gen Xers, depending on whether their parents were late bloomers or early bloomers, I suppose you could say. They've also been called Generation Y, the Net Generation, sometimes Echo Boomers. And when we talk about millennials, we have to specify that we're, on the whole, talking about Western young people in this age group. US, Canada, Western Europe, the developed countries. You can't make sweeping generalizations and put young people from all around the world into this same group necessarily. This is a chart that shows historical events in the lives of baby boomers, Generation X, and millennials, just to give you an idea of the different kinds of things that have marked them and helped define who they are. At the beginning of my course, one of the questions I ask my students is to identify a historical event that is most important to them in their lives. And overwhelmingly, the response is 9/11. Now, I've been teaching them in 2013 and 14, so these are kids who are, I shouldn't say that, should I? These are young people who are in their early 20s, and they remember 9/11 and the impact that it had on them. Other millennials, of course, the younger ones don't even remember it at all. They weren't born yet, some of them. But this particular middle of the generation, that's the most important thing to them. The demographics of millennials, there are about 95 million of them in the United States. They're the most diverse generation to date. As you can see by our graph here, and 20% of them have at least one immigrant parent. Now, the next generation that's coming up, We've already got a potential label for them. People are starting to call them the plurals. And the plurals, the next generation, the non-white minorities will be the majority by the time they come of age. All right, some of the characteristics, and remember these are sort of self-researched or researched and reported by my millennial students. So of course we've already talked about how they're called the net generation due to their relationship with the internet. They're the first digital natives. In other words, they didn't have to adapt to the technology. They've learned it from the beginning. They've never not known it. So they're also referred to as digital natives. Very tech savvy and connected. They text, social network, and play video games, and are connected to mass media, all different kinds of mass media. My students like the idea that they're the first generation in which the grandparents will teach their kids how to play video games. As you heard at the beginning, they're the most educated generation in history. That's true. A larger percentage of them have college degrees than ever before. They're very individualistic in regards to dress, often have tattoos and body piercings. 33% of millennials have at least one tattoo. On the whole, they're liberal and tolerant. They embrace interracial marriage, immigration, gay families, and so on. Now and again, you'll find articles that present an opposing view, and my students captured those as well. For example, one study claims that this generation is less interested in social issues and in others, and is obsessed with money, image, and fame more than any other generation before them. However, that view appears to be in the minority when you look at the material. Every semester, I have my College Writing 2 students take a Pew Research quiz of millennial characteristics, and you can do this too. It's kind of fun. It's called How Millennial Are You? If you'll just Google that, it'll pop right up. It's only about 14 questions, and you can find out what your millennial characteristics are. Markers include things such as media consumption, social attitudes, and lifestyle choices. So just to give you a little picture, in a sample of 13 students from my fall 2013 class, all 13 scored above 33, which was my score. 10 of them scored above 73, which is typically the millennial threshold. And 6 of them scored above 90 in their millennial markers. It's possible that those unusually low scores are explained by the conservative environment that the students are in. For example, one of the things that is asked is whether their parents are married, do they have tattoos, do they have piercings, all of that kind of thing. And it's possible that they have less than the general population. So here are screenshots of my score, and it's kind of hard to see, but the markers up there are, this one right here is where people from the silent generation usually score, that first marker. The second one is where baby boomers usually score, so at 11. So I'm higher than a typical baby boomer. The next one is the Gen Xers. So I score almost like a Gen Xer might in this situation. And then the millennial marker is way up there at 73. So my millennial score versus that of my reader, who is up in above 90 in how millennial she is, which is not surprising. So what do these millennial characteristics, what kind of behaviors do they lead to? Millennials move rather frequently from job to job. Generally more interested in media communication, et cetera, and less in reading. Sad for an English teacher to report. 83% admit to sleeping with their cell phones. They're good communicators. They use technology and control it to serve their needs. They are multitaskers, ambitious, and self-confident team players. As we've already noted, they tend to get lots of tattoos and body piercings. They are less religious than their parents. That's one thing we'll want to talk about and come back to. Very liberal and socially aware. And this is interesting, the most actively vocal generation about views since the protesters of the 1960s. They believe that they can make a difference. In fact, one of the questions on the How Millennial Are You quiz is, have you contacted somebody in government over the past 12 months? And that is a positive marker for a millennial. You might not have expected that, but it is. And then there's the alternative opinion, they're deluded narcissists. So there you go. Now, for all of these little factoids that I've been giving you, I haven't been backing them up with very careful research and references, but I want to give you an example of the type of information that is out there, and a lot of these things that I have been giving you are based on this kind of information from Pew Research Study, which is one of the most respected and prolific and consistent sources of information about the millennial generation. So here's an example from just 1 year ago, a study entitled Millennials in Adulthood. They've carried their survey a little bit further in time than it was originally, now ranging in age from 18 to 33. They are relatively unattached to organized politics and religion, linked by social media, burdened by debt, distrustful of people, in no rush to marry, and optimistic about the future. So here's the chart showing their tendencies in affiliation. You can see on the left-hand side the number of them that consider themselves politically independent compared to the earlier generations. So the top one line is the millennials, this next one down the Gen Xers, the next one down the boomers, and the one at the bottom the silent generation. And then the chart on the left is the percent of adults in this generation who are religiously unaffiliated. And you can see that the millennials are at a much higher level than the previous generations. But this is the kind of research that is out there, and a lot of what I've been giving you is based on this kind of information and materials. So what is the impact likely to be of this generation? They're predicted to be the first generation to do worse than their parents economically. They are big spenders, but they're suffering economically. 16.3% unemployment, nearly double the national rate. And Jeremy says, I'm supposed to tell you that that's not their fault. This is my son. that this is a source of great angst amongst millennials. They are hitting the economy at an extremely tough time, as we all recognize. In fact, the millennials who are at the forefront of their generation came of age in about 2007, 2008. That's when they were trying to get jobs. And we all know that that was not an easy time to be doing that. They're willing to sacrifice liberty for security, and they are very much in favor of stronger government on the whole. They're willing to vote and demonstrate politically. They had a huge impact on the 2008 election of Obama. 2-1 in the under 30 demographic, they voted for Obama. So you remember that Winograd and Hayes, the authors of the book that I looked at and used in my class as the basis for my class, were interested primarily in the political impact of the millennial generation. And I have a quote here from them about that political impact. So of the approximately 95 million millennials now living, only 41% were of voting age in 2008, and they composed less than one-fifth of the electorate that year. When Barack Obama seeks re-election, this was written in 2011, so they're still looking ahead. When Barack Obama seeks re-election in 2012, about 6 in 10 millennials will be eligible to vote, and about 1 in 4 American voters will come from the millennial generation. By 2020, when virtually all members of the generation will be of voting age, millennials will represent more than 1 out of every 3 adults, or 36%. Okay, so let's shift now from thinking about that from a political perspective to thinking about it, those same figures, in terms of the Seventh-day Adventist Church and the influence that the millennials will have on the church going forward from here on out. Imagine this same impact on the church. What does that mean for the Seventh-day Adventist Church? And that's where I'm going to invite my partners here, my colleagues, to pick up on the discussion. You have heard what their credentials are, I think. Kurt wanted me to let you know that he is pinch hitting at the very last minute. Carl Bailey was meant to be here and got sick. And so Kurt has stepped in. His credentials are good. And we're very grateful that you're here. I should say perhaps just another word about Alyssa. She wrote an article in Spectrum last November entitled Millennials' Relationship with the Church, It's Complicated. And in that article, she said this, being a millennial in the Seventh-day Adventist Church means I get to hear a variety of conversations about my generation, but rarely see those questions directed at members of my generation. I do my best to keep up with the various Adventist media, and I've seen many articles about millennials written by people in their 40s, 50s, or older who write with authority about a generation they aren't part of and don't seem to understand. And so I'm afraid we've committed that crime again today to a certain degree, but we are hoping that Alyssa will speak up and that all the other millennials in the congregation, in the audience, will join in when we get to that part of our discussion. So you've seen the list that we had up on the PowerPoint of major characteristics from this generation. What qualities would you add to the list or want to particularly emphasize? And what do you consider to be some of the most important distinguishing features of millennials? Somebody be brave.
Well, I'd just like to point out the fact that, you know, you will sometimes hear these reports that you mentioned where our generation is talked about as very selfish or self-involved, narcissistic. We have those words thrown at us quite often. And the truth of the matter is, you know, the research that I've read, we're extremely empathetic. We care about social causes. We donate our time. We donate monetarily. You know, even when we have student loans to pay off, we're still donating to issues and social causes that matter to us. And so I think that's one of the biggest misconceptions about our generation.
I would second that, too. Nancy?
I think another thing I'd like to add is the millennials grew up with parents who were very involved. I mean, I have two millennials, and we were termed helicopter parents because it was like we were constantly involved in their lives, and we were their cheerleaders, and I remember my mom not really knowing. She knew I went to a good school, but she didn't know my teachers. She didn't know really my friends' names. I knew all their teachers. I knew their friends. I was parent of the classroom. And
did
I think
you register them for classes?
Just about, no. I actually had to pull myself back to start letting them do. But I think as a generation, they're very close to their parents. Their parents had a big part in their childhood and teenage years, and they continue to see family and friends as very important.
Mm-hmm. When PBS did, they were very early on the front edge of this whole investigating of the millennial generation, and Judy Woodruff traveled across the United States, and they produced two documentaries about Generation Next, they called it at the time. And on the whole, the people that they talked with were very close to their parents, and there doesn't seem to be the big divide and rejection and rebellion on the whole. Obviously, all of this is individual, but they do get along well with their parents. I think I've seen that as well in the material.
We have to pay their college.
Well, I think their debt, their student debt, is certainly much higher than any of us. And I've been intrigued how Obama picked up on that and wants to pass legislation so that they can have some kind of reprieve in their student loans, because they're huge. And they actually, you know, like you mentioned, came during the financial recession. So.
Yeah, one thing I would like to mention is that they are, as you mentioned, one of the most educated generations. So that means that critical thought is a bit more present there than maybe the previous generations. And in the study we were doing, we discovered that studying the beliefs of the church is not very effective to do proof texting. So it's more questioning, you know, can we really use this text? And it's more important to show how this relates to their life instead and present it in a way that they say, yes, this is important, this will make a difference in my life. So it's a bit different approach that this generation have than maybe the previous ones. I think it started with the X's, you know, but it's even more so with the millennials.
So they're critical thinkers.
Yeah, mm-hmm. Heading that direction, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Good.
I'll preface this by saying that my 13-year-old the other day said, "Dad, you know absolutely nothing about us." So with that on the table, part of this, I think, is based on a bit of research that Dwayne McBride and I and several others did on the Hope Channel. The Hope Channel was interested in having, is this not on? Need to
I
be
don't
closer.
Think so.
The Hope Channel was interested in having us explore what were the perspectives of students on Andrew's campus around certain issues, and two issues emerged. One was authenticity. I think there's a great interest on the part of students of the millennial generation in being authentic, and that means authenticity in music. It means authenticity in personal relationships. One of the things that I found really interesting is that this is a generation that is incredibly eclectic in terms of its musical tastes, in part because they no longer purchase music like we used to do. They just find it, and it's on the internet, and so it's available, and so they use music in the way that I had never experienced before. But their authenticity has to do with they love various styles of music. It doesn't matter if it's bluegrass or if it's classical or if it's gospel or if it's hip-hop. What they want is they want authenticity in their musical styles. They don't like to have music that pretends to be one thing and really isn't. And then the other thing that I've noticed in my own kids' lives is community. A very strong interest in relationships and friendships and communities and networks. And part of that is evidenced by the use of social media to stay connected with everyone at all times.
Leanne, our remote panel member here.
I'll talk really loudly.
Yeah.
I just wanted to reiterate that focuses on it was interesting that the presentation it said that they were very, very liberal. In the Beyond Belief study, we asked them about
thank you.
I would say that I think there's an interesting juxtaposition between, you know, for millennial Adventists, because we, I would say, are far more liberal than other Adventists in other generations. But when it comes to millennials that are in the rest of the world, we're much more conservative. And so we're in this interesting kind of no man's land for our beliefs.
I think another interesting trait of millennials that probably have a lot to do with us in our church is that they're not willing to settle, you know, wanting to be genuine and authentic. They're not willing to just settle with what they're fed. They will question it. It's very important to them to be a part of. You know, it's amazing to me how the advertising world has really picked up on this. I don't know if you heard recently, Lay's potato chips sent out a message saying, invent your own flavors and we'll put them in and see if it works. And a lot of people responded to that. And I can remember a few years back, my son gave me a pair of Converse tennis shoes for my birthday. And he literally picked the color of each part of the shoe with the shoelace. That kind of interaction, that kind of show of we're interested in hearing from the people out there is very key, and I think has implications for us as a church as well.
Anybody want to add anything that we haven't addressed yet?
Well, I think just adding on to what Nancy said, you know, we are a generation that we have all of the information we need at our fingertips already. We, you know, whether it comes to Lay's potato chips or any other corporation out there, we can tweet at them, we can post on their Facebook page if we're happy, if we're not happy. We have these direct relationships, it feels like, with authority figures, whether in the advertising world, whether actors and actresses. We're reaching out and we're having conversations with those people. And a lot of times when it comes to the church, it feels like we're very disconnected from the church leaders. And we feel that they don't want to hear from us. They don't think that we have anything worth saying. And yet we have these very authentic conversations with the rest of the world.
You were saying the other day when we were talking about this, how millennials can check their facts at any point.
Yes. You want to? And I think, you know, Carl Bailey had said, you know, we sit there in church and you think we're not listening to the sermon, but we're actually fact-checking on our phone and just Googling what the pastor is saying. And that's just something that comes very naturally to us. And so it is very important for us, you know, going back to the authenticity thing, that, you know, what our pastors are telling us, what our authority figures in the church are saying to us, is true and genuine and authentic and gels with what we believe for ourselves and what we're seeing out there in the rest of the world.
Okay.
And I think connecting to that, it's really incredible how social media, I mean, it has changed countries, as we know, Egypt. Yeah. And it has allowed individuals to find out stuff that their leaders would not want them to know. Sort of what the books did at some point, and the printed word, and then TV did it again. But I think now social media is just incredibly, there are no boundaries. And so what I've seen in the millennials that I work with is there is incredible acceptance and diversity of ideas, diversity of perspectives, diversity, there's an acceptance of diversity in religions, and it's moving to see that in the millennials I work with.
It also allows them to live vicariously as well through other people.
That's true.
They don't have to be a single mother anymore to know where a single mother might be going to.
Right.
And not just one single mother, but maybe 20 single mothers. So that's going to sort of change the way that they're going to have towards another person who may not have that contact with a certain type of person and may not be able to take
they have access to the information. So let's move to, we've already started in that direction. It's inevitable, I think, in our environment and discussion. What do we know about the religious views of millennials in general? And then we're going to start to focus it more on millennials within the Adventist Church and what their religious views and attitudes are.
Oh, I can talk about Adventism, but so we can do that afterwards.
Yes, yeah. We're going to go there for sure. Yes, uh-huh. What do we know in general? I mean, one of the things that sort of bothers me is this idea that millennials are less religious simply because they're unaffiliated with religions. Do you think that that equates? That is that what makes them less religious? When you go on and look at the other Pew Research Center studies, they engage in daily prayer, they go to worship services, they engage in reading the Bible, and I'm not talking about Adventists here. This is a general religious study by Pew Research at roughly the same levels as their forebears did when they were that age. In other words, they're at about the same level that their parents and grandparents were when their grandparents and parents were 18 to 30 years old. So is it fair to say, do you think, that millennials are less religious?
I would say, in general, millennials don't like labels. Right. And the idea of organized religion, it's difficult for millennials to see the good that organized religion does. We see a lot of the bad that it does, a lot of the exclusion, excluding different people groups based on their differences. And millennials being very inclusive drift away from organized religion, but that doesn't mean we're not religious or not spiritual.
I think it always helps to understand the world in which they grew up in. And, you know, they don't really trust authority figures. We've gone through Enron, and I mean, they've gone through Enron and Clinton and on. And so they've seen that you can't always trust those who are leading out. They've seen their parents lose their jobs and their retirement because of switches. And so they don't trust a lot those who are leading out. And I think that's why they crave to be involved, be a part of, I think as those who feel they can find that niche in their faith, where they can actually participate and be a part of the planning and the executing, I think they feel much more vibrant in their faith.
Leanne is otherwise occupied at the moment, I think. Okay.
Oh,
the microphones, yes. Okay. Well,
I'd like to say something here. And since I retired 15 years ago, about the only close connection I have with what I would call the younger element
or the student. If there is any significance at all in the millennial generation, it took place in a space that some other social situations allowed them to fit into. And sometimes they agree and sometimes they disagree with these social situations that they find themselves squeezed into and identified by, but the question is, what are they doing about it? I mean, I read a lot of web pages, and I read the comments afterwards, and I don't know whether those are Generation Xers or whether they're millennialists or whatever they are, but there's a considerable scattergun approach to knowledge in those. It's sort of like you walk down the street and have the microphone and ask somebody that walks by, what do you think of this or what do you think of that? I would think that a millennial generation person, if they are to be taken seriously at all, would ought to be, they should be able to place in your hand or on your computer or on your smartphone a list of letters they've written to their leaders, including Ted Wilson, to tell them what you think about this or what you think about this and show your pleasure or your displeasure. If you voted for Obama in the last election and you think that his health care plan is okay, have you written him and told him to get rid of his war party, his neoconservative troublemakers? I mean, there's hardly a week that goes by that I don't involve myself in this kind of thing, whether it's on war or on social issues or on the environment. But the question I think that you young'uns need to ask yourself is, are we as particulated as the kinds of data that function in our dream world? In other words, it's all chaotic and your mind's going to put it together in some way, regardless of whether it comes out sensible or nonsensible. And so if you want to get me to really respect you as a, you know, the millennialist or the millennial generation, I want to see your vita.
Well, I think you said a lot of interesting points there, one of which that you ended on is if you want us to have your respect. I would say overall millennials don't need your respect. that's
so if you want to pay your debts.
You know, we're paying our own debts as well. That's a common misconception. One of the things you said at the beginning of what you said, you know, you said, what are we doing about it? What are we doing about these views that we have? We're doing a lot, actually. And I think, you know, Meredith had mentioned in her PowerPoint that, you know, we do write letters. But I think the landscape is changing because letters, that's not really where it's at anymore. It's at social media. We are tweeting at our representatives and our you know, the senators, the president. You know, he's on Twitter too. And we can just go and we can send him, you know, a tweet. We can post on his Facebook page. We can do all sorts of things. We can start petitions, and we do all of that. Do we also write letters? Sure, but more and more, we are more likely to be on social media and putting our opinions out there. In addition, other things that we're doing that have to do with our social causes that we believe in, I'm sure Meredith's already aware, there's a 2014 Millennial Impact Report where this group of researchers specifically looked at what are millennials doing in society. And 87% of millennials surveyed made a monetary donation last year. And 47% volunteered, actually spent time volunteering in their community. So the idea that we're not doing anything is a common misconception and an extremely dangerous one to perpetuate.
I think we've seen signs of that in our own community. About a year ago, I know a family suffered the loss of the husband with a heart attack. And they didn't have the funds. They were students. They didn't have the funds. And somebody, a millennial, put up in earning money site, and there's names for that, I'm sure. There we go. Kickstart. And within a week, they had the money for the funeral, the casket. They will find out what your company stands for and whether you are responsible in social issues or do you harm animals, and they will stay away. They're very, very active, actually, from what I've seen from my own students and kids.
Maybe let's, did you want to say something, Kurt?
Well, I was just going to say that part of the reason why there may not be more activity within the Adventist Church is that we really don't have a communication structure that allows for tweeting and email. I think the power structure emails. I'm not even always sure of that, but they do email. All right, that's good. But I don't think Facebook pages would be the term. But yeah, I think that's right. I don't think we have a structure that really is 21st century, and so there's really no way that millennials can communicate actively and efficiently, which is important, with church leaders.
Yeah. Maybe this is a good time for us to get Jan to talk to us a little bit about the study that he and Leanne were involved in. Paul Peterson also worked with them, and he's going to show us some samples. This is a huge study, and he's going to give us a taste of it today, and the kinds of things that they looked at.
Yeah, I have to start with a correction here. I'm not associated with the seminary. I'm associated with the Ridge Department, so it's hosted by the Ridge Department. So Paul Peterson is the head of the Ridge Department, and he's on our research team. We have some retention issues when it comes to millennials and the church. And so one thing that we were interested in to find out is, what do the young millennials really think about the beliefs of our church? Because if we're going to retain them, you know, we need to know what they think about our beliefs. And so so we set out to find out what they really feel about the 28 beliefs of our church and how well they know these beliefs. So most of our participants were baptized members. They had grown up in the Adventist church. They had parents, grandparents were Adventists. And so we were kind of wondering, what do they actually know about these beliefs? And how would they describe these beliefs in their own world, in their own words? And we also want to see how effective it is to run a general education class about our beliefs and see how that measures up. So we wanted to collect a data set relating to the beliefs and the social and behavioral issues and focusing on the beliefs or the issues that the young millennials themselves pointed out in the responses that we collected. And so we had already done phase two. We are in the middle of phase one. We are in the middle of phase two, and we have a third phase that we are in the process of doing. So in the first phase, we had a smaller group that we assumed that we don't know anything at all. Okay, so we started with a small group that we wanted to find out what did they think was important with these beliefs. If they liked them or didn't like them. And if they even thought these were relevant in their life. So we asked them to write 150 to 200 words on each of the belief statements. So we had 28 all in all, so we ended up with an enormous amount of data based on this study. And based on these responses, we then developed a survey that we used in the second phase of the study. And we made 90 questions based on the responses that we saw from the first group. And we had about a third of all the undergrad students here at Andrews participating in that part of the study. So the first phase, we published already the findings, is in this book. If you are interested to read the responses that they gave to each of the fundamentals, we also added that into this book. So if you, as I mentioned, their emails or the letters and all that, what do they really think? Well, in this book, you can actually read what this group had to say about each of the individual beliefs, what they liked about them, what they didn't like about them, if they thought this was relevant or not, or important or not. In the third phase, and that's what we are working on now, is to look at the rest of the world. We looked at North America, at Andrews University. I had to say 30% of the participants were born outside America, so it's still a very international group. But we think it's important to also have a look at replicate a study in other countries and to take that into consideration. So there are several outcomes that we wanted for this study. The first one is to provide a new commentary to the belief statements. Because the one we have was written quite a while ago with a different audience than mine. This time we would like to have a commentary that is intended for young adults. And so one part that we've done in our study is we have about 150 students or participants that have written their commentary to one of the fundamentals. So we use that material in order to focus on what they themselves find important and how they would explain it to their fellow millennials. We are also developing a curriculum to make it more effective how we explain the fundamental beliefs to the millennials. And we're also working on a textbook. So far we have come out with one book that you can read, the responses to the beliefs. And we are working on a second book that will be out this summer that are looking at the 90 questions that we asked, so you can read their responses. And we have already provided two reports that you can read, one on women ordination, because that's one of the big issues this summer, if women should be ordained. What do the young think about it? What do the millennials think about this? Are they for it or against, or what sort of attitudes do they have? We also looked at the creation issue, because that's also one of the fundamentals that will be possibly revised this summer. And again, what do the young people think about the creation? What was created during the creation week? When did it happen? You know, so that's all part of the second report. And then we have two more reports that is almost done that we will put online, one on peer ministry and one on early baptism. Because one of the issues that the older generation have been pushing is to get the young baptized as early as possible, because they somehow think that this is related to retention, that if you get them in, get them into the church book, then they will stay in the church. We asked the young, what do they really think about baptism, you know? And we got a lot of responses on it. It's quite, some of them are quite sad to read, because they had a very negative experience about this. And we asked them, the ones that were baptized before they started in high school, two-thirds of them said, I wish I could have waited till I was older, if I can do it again. And so these are some of the, we had good intention, you know, and we think this is a good idea, but we need to ask the millennials, what do they really think about it? So if you're interested to learn more about this study, you can go online you can read the reports that we already have, and you can also keep an eye on future reports that are becoming available the next few months. So that's what we have been doing, and it's been very fascinating, learning a lot of new things. And I have to say, the challenge that we as church leaders would have, or educators, is to explain why it matters. Yes, you have all these nice beliefs, you know, but so what? How does this relate to my life? How? What sort of difference is this really going to make for me? And so that's our challenge, is to present it in a way that they can see, yes, this makes sense. You know, this will make a difference in my life. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
So, that brings us to the topic of what are the things that the Adventist Church has to offer this millennial generation, and what are the things about the Adventist Church that are most frustrating, perhaps, to millennials? Do we have a sense of what those might be?
Hello, can you hear me? Yes. When we investigated what they liked about the beliefs, they were pretty positive towards the beliefs. And I think that's something that's quite salient, that when they actually knew what the beliefs were, they were very, very positive towards them. What we found, though, was that most of them didn't know what the beliefs were, which was interesting given that 90% or a little bit over 90% were baptized. And one would assume that they did classes prior to baptism where they would have gone over the beliefs, but it seems as though that hasn't happened. The emphasis has been on baptizing them as early as possible, and training them in the beliefs comes later. Well, if you're a busy pastor, you have a lot of demands on your time. Once you've baptized them, you might go, oh, phew, great, got them. and that post-baptismal education may not have been at the top of your priority list. Not that that's, you know, it might also be that they were so busy too, and that's not something that would come to their mind to continue with young people. But when they know these beliefs, they like them.
Good. You want to add to that?
Well, I have to say the most popular belief is the Sabbath. You know, so when we looked at all the responses
amongst the millennials,
Yeah, but it might not be for the reason that we think. You know, but the emphasis was that this is a day you can take off guilt-free. You know, so you can rest. Mm-hmm. But it has something to do with where you are in life. You know, if you are busy studying and all that, yes, it is good to have a day off where you can relax without feeling bad about it. Pardon me?
It's intergenerational.
Yeah.
Every generation.
There's also, with relation to vegetarianism,
they are very socially conscious. And when we looked at stewardship, it was not only just stewardship in the sense of giving your tithe, which, interestingly, a lot of them do pay, most of them do pay tithe. When they didn't pay tithe, it was more because they didn't have a job. With this, it was interesting with vegetarianism that, you know, not only stewardship of their church, but also stewardship of the earth was very important to them as well too. And that when we sell vegetarianism to this group, it might not be the best thing to say, hey, you can be healthy if you are a vegetarian. Social consciousness about, okay, if you're going to be a vegetarian, what happened to that animal before it arrived on your plate? That seems to resonate more with the sample that we looked at rather than a health perspective. Because let's face it, they're young, they're healthy. It doesn't matter whether they eat meat or not, they're still healthy. But when there's a social conscience attached to vegetarianism and the choices that they make with regard to that, it's a little different.
And the large majority are not vegetarians, so just point that out, because that has been traditionally an important part in Adventism, to focus on health and vegetarianism. But with this generation, where they want to participate in our study, the big majority are not vegetarians.
So there are some things that are very attractive to the millennials in regards to the church.
I mean, I think when it comes to the overarching beliefs, you know, the 28 fundamental beliefs, I don't run into many millennials that take issue with those at all. You know, like Leanne said, you know, we have a pretty positive view of those when we know what they are. But when it comes to the way that the church relates to people on a day-to-day basis, I think that's where millennials start to have trouble and really take issue with the way the church treats people, which has little to nothing to do with the fundamental beliefs.
So, Jan,
what? Well, maybe ask them, okay, what don't you like about the church? I mean, when you do a study, you have to ask both sides. What do you like about it? What don't you like about it? And when you look at the answers that were writing in, what they didn't like is too judgmental. So they felt that the church was judging too much, you know. And when we looked at Christian living, you know, they liked that we have standards. But when it comes to being told how to live these standards out, that becomes a different issue. Yes, we have to leave it up to the millennials themselves to figure out what do they do with these principles. Yes, it's good to have principles. I'm a Christian, you know, I'm an Adventist. We are supposed to be different, but let them decide how they would do that in their lives.
And I think, you know, that base, plus they have access to everybody and they hear everybody's stories, and the stories are their stories of their friends and their relatives. So the LGBT issues, which are the gay and lesbian, bisexual, transgender questioning issues, are something that they have a hard time understanding. Why our church is having such a hard time in loving these people and accepting them, and why the message tends to be one that alienates them from our church and lead so many to kick their kids out of the house and lead many to commit suicide. And that goes against what they're all for inclusion and loving them. And, you know, when I went through high school, I went to Monterey Bay Academy, and I didn't know there were gays in the school. I didn't even know really what the word homosexual meant. Today, it's a very different world. You know, people aren't having to live in secret anymore, and their stories do count. And I've had gay young people say to me, the church was killing me, and I had to leave, because it was literally killing them to stay in the church and hear the microaggressions on a daily basis. Just this morning, one of my students tweeted me saying that she was in a church service and they were talking about homosexuals. And she said, I can't believe how wrong the information is that they're giving. And again, they can fact find, they can tweet, they can get on the Facebook, they can do research on their own. And it's catching some of us in a cross of beliefs, I think.
Yeah, I think, you know, we are a very story-driven generation. We, like Nancy said, you know, we hear people's stories and we empathize with what they're going through. And, you know, like Leanne mentioned, you know, you don't have to be a single mother to know what a single mother's life is like. You don't have to, you know, be LGBT to hear these very traumatic stories of the way they've been treated by the church and people in the church, well-meaning or not. And that isolates us from the church, because we look at that and we look at just the way people are treated day to day, and we don't like it, and we don't see why we should continue to be part of something that is, you know, so damaging to individuals.
One other thing that we found when we were reading all the responses was there was an underlying in the behavioral sciences, it's called paternalism. Doesn't mean it has nothing to do, not to be confused with patriarchy, but paternalism is when, or adultism is another word for it as well, too. It's when a group of people try to make decisions and come up with ideas for another group of people, even though the first group won't actually suffer any negative consequences if they were wrong. We found that that was something that came up a lot in responses. It seems as though older people in the church seem to want to say to young people, and that what they had heard was that this is the way you should be, this is the way you should think, this is what you should do, even though that might not even be relevant for young people. An example of this is the early baptism issue. It's interesting, some research found that there was a correlation between early baptism and retention. Now, what that research didn't take into consideration was that just because you have a correlation doesn't mean that one is causing the other. It's interesting, but you don't have evidence of cause and effect. So from that, it was like, baptize them as early as possible. And then we were getting responses like, I was shoved into the baptismal font. One young person was forced to get baptized. One young person said that, how did they say it? That I feel as though I've been robbed of making a mature decision for Christ because you wanted me to be baptized. It was so important to be baptized that my mature decision was not a priority to you. That's pretty serious. And I suppose with millennial young adults, we really can't tell. I mean, these are adults. These are educated adults. You can't tell an educated adult, you have to do this, you have to do that, you have to do the other. But again, they have good ideas. I say let them run with it.
As we continue the discussion about the implications for the Adventist Church, why don't we open it up to questions from the audience? And we've got a couple already here and some other hands. And so, please.
Well,
there's one just behind you. Just a minute. We'll get to you next.
I have more of a comment. I feel like when it comes to what frustrates millennials as a millennial, I feel like it's the fear of change that is in the Adventist Church. And that's something that I personally have experienced. There is this underlying idea that when we come up and we want to change something or we want to do something, I've been confronted with leaders of the church who feel like that translates to changing the beliefs and changing the church as a whole. And that's not everybody, but when you're confronted with that, it gets very frustrating because a lot of my friends, regardless of whether they're conservative or liberal or whatever, they uphold the values of the church. They're like, we're not trying to change the church, but we're trying to change the approach. Because when it really comes down to it, we're preaching to our generation. And you know, as an educated generation, when we're asking all these questions, it's because they're being asked to us. I grew up completely in a public school system. And every time I approached my friends, or my friends asked me questions because they knew I was a Christian, they were difficult questions, questions I had never asked, questions that had never been answered in church. And my father's a pastor, and I'd go up to him and I'd ask him these things, and he'd sometimes stop to think, and he'd be like, I'll give you an answer in a minute. Or you'd have to go actually look and actually ponder about things. Because if I don't have the answers, even though the questions may be difficult or a bit crazy to some people, I can't preach to the people that are asking me these answers. Because just as much as we want to know, that's the same way that the millennials in the world want to know.
Right.
So I feel like we need that to be able to reach them.
Good comment. Thank you.
I've just recently become aware, maybe I'm overly aware, of what seems to be a bit of rivalry between what is known as GYC and the One Place. And I'm wondering how millennials relate to this. Is this just a leadership issue, or is this a millennial issue?
We need to ask the millennials. I'm not going to try to answer that one. Yes, there are some. Melody had her hand up, yeah.
We'll work our way back.
At the next general conference, they're going to tighten the doctrinal definitions for a number of the fundamental beliefs, especially the one on creation. Is that direction toward tighter definition kind of counterintuitive in the light of what I think I'm hearing about the millennium? Or do the millennials even care? That's my question.
Well, I'm hesitant to speak on behalf of any other millennials on that specific issue, but I'll say for me personally, you know, I grew up in the Adventist school system here, actually, Ruth Murdoch Andrews Academy, Andrews University, and I don't particularly care personally about this huge debate that's going on right now, but I wish I had had the opportunity to be taught the other views on creation, because all I ever heard was the six-day creation theory. And to get out into the rest of the world and realize, oh, there's all these other theories, and some of them have some strong evidence in support of them, I just wish I had had the opportunity to hear all of the different views.
Can I just come with a commentary? If you go online to our website, we have a report just on the creation issue, because we did ask them what sort of creation view they have and how strongly they felt about it, and what they how they respond to it if they found out that their position was wrong, you know, or it was something else. And what I found most surprising was that the view that the whole universe was created during the six-day Creation Week 6,000 years ago seemed to be the most prominent view of the participant in our study. And the second most prominent was that, yes, God created life on Earth during the Creation Week, but we had no idea when it happened. And that view was more prominent among the ones that had gone to public school before they came to an Adventist university. So they had been exposed more to other theories, but they still want to hold on to a view in a creator God. So we don't know when it really happened.
The young earth versus older issue.
Yeah, but the most prominent one had to do with the whole universe was created 6,000 years ago. Mm-hmm. But the view that life on earth was created six to 10,000 years ago were the third most popular, and that was significantly like 15% that had that view. So African American participants were more likely to believe that yes, God created life on Earth during the week, but we don't know when it happened. But Caucasians and Hispanic were more likely to believe the whole universe was created during that week.
I think one of the reasons that we have so much difficulty understanding this generation or talking about our generation is because that, like, our generation is by definition undefinable. We are unified by diversity. We are defined by the fact that we refuse to accept, like, one meta-narrative without examining it. We're very educated, but we're also very pluralistic. And so because of social media gets a hugely bad rap, partially, I think, because it's difficult to understand. It changes so quickly. I'm already starting to think this. Like, my brother's in high school, and he's talking about stuff, and I'm like, I have not heard of that. That is too much for me. But it allows us to have... how can I say this properly? Okay. So prior to the advent of social media, your exposure was very much from where you were. You saw things from your perspective, usually alone, your region, your town, your church, whatever. And yeah, you have letters and newspapers and stuff like that, but often the people who could purveyors of information and distributors of information were in places of power. And what we see is this, like, vast destabilization of power structures where anyone can have a voice now, and you get this kind of grassroots movements. We refer to, like, well, I was thinking when you were saying, well, why don't we write letters to our congressmen, to our... We don't trust them because we don't trust big, like, top-down authority figures to write to us. We don't trust institutions to tell us what to believe. We're intensely individualistic and intensely involved in community at the same time. And so, I know I'm not making sense, but that's because we're really, really fragmented. We will be fiercely individualistic in believing what we want to believe, but we also trust our peers more than we trust anyone who wants to arrive and give us a cut and dried idea of what to believe. We're pick and choosers who, as you said, basically have values of authenticity. We don't care what you're selling unless you're acting it. And I'm rambling because I get really passionate about this. But I think it's so difficult to put us into boxes because that's what we resist more than anything else, is having other people, you were saying paternally, telling us what we do and how we think, because the point is that we don't think in one way.
To answer your question, I do think it is very counterintuitive for a lot of the reasons that Melody just said. For the most part, our generation is very skeptical of the facts that people tell us, or when they say, this is the one specific thing that you should believe, this is the one way to talk about. We value discussion much more than we value facts, which is going to be really hard for our church to adjust to. I think that Adventism for so long has been based on this idea that we have the truth, that our evangelistic series are usually like, look at all these biblical facts, look at all the facts, these facts, more facts, look, we are so right, we must have the truth. But in doing this, I think a lot of times it detracts from the discussion that our generation really wants. Mm-hmm. And so by narrowing further a lot of the fundamental beliefs, we see that as cutting down on potential discussion, of further narrowing what we're being told to believe. And I think that's a very uncomfortable position for most millennials.
Okay. I want to make another quick comment on the early baptism bit. I do feel like I was baptized too early, and when I took baptismal classes, I went to a one-room school ranging from grades 1 to 8, and there were 5 of us taking the class. And if I hadn't chosen to be baptized, I would have been the only one who wouldn't have chosen. So I also feel like baptism is being pushed by peer pressure as well as other things.
Good. Thank you. Did we have other hands? And back there.
It seems... Is this on?
Yeah.
It seems as though... And this is a question. There are individuals, and then they communicate in communities. And then at some point, this community morphs into a culture. And it seems to me that the culture really is the problem. And I think that as far as my relationship with the church, that they're more interested in markers than they are in values.
There's another hand back there, and we'll see if someone picks it up. Ken.
I think one of the things that I realize, especially our generation, is as the church wrestles with the question of probably beliefs or where we are, one of the concerns for Millennium is how does the doctrine or how do the doctrines really help me each day? Mm-hmm. We know we ask the question, it's not about it is right, intellectual, is, you know, does it make sense? We ask the question, how do the fundamental beliefs, how do they help me each day? You know, it's good when we study, it's logical, whatever we study, we have the knowledge. But one of the millennials, even when you speak to them, they want to know what you speak after you speak the truth. Yes, it's the truth, but how does it help me when I leave this place? And in most cases, you know, simple message for the millennials, whether they are within the church or outside the church, if we can connect the truth with how they live and how it will make a difference when I get out, then you connect with them. But if I explain whatever I explain to them without really putting the connection of how it is helping them, the truth is not important anymore if it's not really helping me now to do whatever I need to do.
That sounds like another version of the authenticity, the personal connection that has been described by our millennials.
Reading all the responses, you know, is quite fascinating. And one of the fundamentals is the unity of the church, you know. And they thought this was a really nice belief, you know. They liked the idea of unity. But some of the responses was like, why even bother having this fundamental, because it's not really followed in the church? So yes, we have this here, but we don't follow it. So why is it here among the beliefs?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. As Kurt said, you know, he and I have done a lot of surveys among different generations. And really one of the, I think, most admirable things about millennials is that service engagement. You know, when the Red Cross loves to come to Andrews, we always exceed our goal in blood giving. You know, this is the favorite place to come for blood. Couples go and hold hands and give blood together. So, you know, the service engagement of this generation really is very high. And, you know, we've seen that the surveys we've done every 5 years are very high service engagement. But there's a very good point made by the folks over here, is that this generation is harder to define than any other previous generation. And for many reasons, it is extremely eclectic and willing to hold in tension many diverse ideas that previous generations would have to resolve, and this generation doesn't. But it's also a part of the multi-ethnicness of this generation. There is no meta-ethnic narrative anymore in the millennial generation. It is not a majority white generation. And so that's really very different. And so the diversity of ethnic heritage and culture makes for a multimodal attitudes and belief system. You talk about different beliefs from Latin, Hispanics, African Americans, whites. And that's what really we see, is that there's many ethnic cultural heritage narratives out there that debate for a place among millennials. And so it is the highest intermarriage of any previous generation. So it's a very, there's no more ethnic cultural meta narrative. It really is a very eclectic, pluralistic heritage discussion in terms of who this generation is. The boomers, we're very, very white. And we are the largest number of white people ever born in the United States. And so our meta-narrative is white culture really, you know, defined the generation. Millennials are not defined by one ethnic heritage. It's a very diverse, very eclectic, very pluralistic generation. It's really hard, as you said, to put in a category. Though I see you're all white. Anyway.
Can I just add really quickly to Duane's comment that one of the things that on a recent study that I've been working on with elementary and middle school girls, and I realize that that's falling just shy of the millennial generation, but it's showing the tipping point on multi-ethnic kinds of perspectives. This is like 800 girls in Berrien County. The most common ethnic identified, self-identified category was white, which was
40-some percent. The second most common was what they self-identified as multi-ethnic, which meant that they weren't willing to self-identify as any of the other groups. They weren't willing to identify as African-American or Black. They weren't willing to identify as Hispanic or Latino. And they weren't willing to identify as Asian or, I'm trying to remember what other categories we put together. Those fell off the map. The second most common category was multi-ethnic. They were neither of those categories and didn't feel like they could self-identify. And that's part of where you get that complexity in diversity and complexity in responses that I think that Melody said so well.
Just a couple comments, and one is along the lines of what Joe Gregg was saying. In his defense, I do remember some time ago, Joe, that we did go through about 10 years of college students who really didn't seem to care about the issues, but that's dramatically changed over the last 10, 15 years. Yeah. And that's about how long you've been retired, right? So I'm really thankful for that. I'm truly thankful to see how much college students care about social issues. And the other comment is that although I can't claim to understand millennials very well at all, one thing I have noticed in my classrooms is that people, let me say it this way, ideas, beliefs, things, and facts have often in the past been more important than people. But now to my college students, people trump those other things. Structures, ideas, facts, beliefs, they're all important. And things, they're all important, but people trump those things. And frankly, I think that's a really important self-correction that is being made in this generation right now. And thank you very much. I'm so pleased to see that.
That's so true. And I think, you know, one of the things that we haven't mentioned yet is reverse mentoring. And there's so many of us in this room that would not know how to send an email or
make a PowerPoint
or just getting the computer on. And there's so much we turn to them, you know, how do I get my smart TV smart, you know, and how do I download this? And exactly. And yet when it comes to other important issues, we say, no, we've got it all. We've got all our facts in order. We really don't want your feedback. And so they're being thrown into two different worlds, two messages from us.
Well, I think, you know, the idea that we don't have, you know, a system of values is incredibly false. You know, back to, you know, what Melody was saying, we have values, but they're shifting from the previous generations. Our values are less on facts, and they're more on, you know, love and compassion and generosity, hospitality, you know, the individuals. That's what we value. Community.
Community, yeah.
Just a quick comment. My wife and I are, we are baby boomers. Proud of it. But that said, we have two millennials, two sons, 32 and 28. And I guess I'm going to comment real quickly on their spirituality. You know, there are some things that they will do in relationship to our faith, you know, that make us cringe, right? But then there are other things that really let me know that they're still in tune, that they're open to God. I'll give you one quick example. My oldest son sent me an app from a church in North Carolina called the Elevation Church, and he listens every now and then to sermons by this Stephen Furtick. If those of you have heard, you know what I'm talking about. But he has these powerful sermons, and I think what my son's point in sending me that, and I think what he deals with in life and what he's open to is he will find truth wherever he finds it, and he'll measure it, you know, by First Thessalonians 5:21, you know,
measure everything, hold fast to that, which is good. And I found that I've grown from some of the sermons that I've heard from this preacher. He does attend Adventist church. He is open to the Adventist beliefs, but he's also open to other perspectives that give him strength to make it through the day. And I find that to be very uplifting. Melinda and I take heart to know that he is still seeking God, even though he may find truth in outside of the Adventist church.
Well, I'm here, professor, brand new professor at School of Education, Leadership and Higher Education. I'm doing different studies, mostly in higher education. And currently I'm studying, for example, the emerging trend of different organizations that support community engagement at university level. And it's very interesting that from the 80s here, for example, in the US, you have this campus, Compact Campus organization, and it's growing literally wildly in the whole country, supporting structures within the universities to connect academia with communities, with civic engagement. And it's very, very interesting to see, for example, University Tufts University in Boston, they have a whole college. It's College of Community and Civic Engagement. They don't teach one single class. The college organizes the whole communication between these different colleges in the university with community and students. They promote this. And I think we're in the middle of a what I would call a epistemological change. People are realizing that problems, current problems, are not possible to face, to approach them from one or two point of view. So now, for example, you have some universities offering degrees with for example, Duke and East and Pittsburgh, four different fields, economy, history, policy, and different areas to approach, for example, ecology. Why? Because it's so complex in order to fix ecological problems that you cannot do it from one or two disciplines. So this generation are seeing our current problems as an organization. They see us as very blind. Say, how in the world are you going to do the whole thing just with one point of view? We have to sit and discuss, because this is a lot more complex than you think. So that's why they react. They don't like it. That's my opinion. I have a 17, almost 18 years old girl. I mean, I know. Yeah. She didn't talk about that. And she said, but why in the world you see this? You have to, you know, different points. And that's why.
I think this is a good time to stop. This is intended to be a continuing conversation. Okay, one last comment, Lauren.
I don't know whether this is I suppose it's a couple of questions too, actually, which may be more for the sake of reflection than they are a specific answer. I grew up in the generation of the 60s, where we had the Flower Children in Berkeley and so on, Make Love, Not War. And it was a countercultural phenomenon, which we didn't expect to change. But by the time the 60s got to the early 70s, there was a cover on Life magazine, I believe, that said it's the me generation. And all of the concerns for community and love and caring and anti-establishment somehow went out the window, and the folks of us who were part of that generation apparently got co-opted into becoming part of the establishment. So my first question is, are there elements in your view of the world, and I'm seeing community and involvement as being very key, and maybe the most two salient points, which I think I'd have to agree with Shondell, I congratulate you on, but are there elements that you have to be aware of, or that might become, that you might need to become aware of, that might make you jaded, that would co-opt you into somehow becoming something that you didn't expect to be and don't really want to be given your outlook and your positive view now? That's one question relative to where you are amongst those educated within the West. The second question for reflection is, the West is coming up against much of the rest of the world, which most recently is a violent confrontation among those who would look to the back to the past, specifically a caliphate that they would like to see re-established and ultimately take over the world, according to some extreme views. Obviously, I understand that doesn't represent everyone, of course. But nonetheless, it is an established view that is very much based on violence. And there are those who would say the United States is the greatest purveyor of violence in the world today and has been, and that much of what we're seeing is a reaction against that. So my question is, when you look at community and involvement and so on, from your perspective, there is a time in which you may come up against those other elements in the world, and I'm glad to see that your Beyond Beliefs is going worldwide in terms of your questioning. And that's within the Adventist Church, but the Adventist Church supposedly is a movement that has something to say for the entire world as well. So how do you respond to those kinds of things? Discussion, as was suggested over here, I think is very important. But let me just leave with you a quote I heard recently of Gandhi's that may be of some encouragement, and that is, he said, first they ignore us, then they laugh at us, then they fight us, then we win.
Okay, that I say this was going to be a continuing conversation, a lot more material here. We hope to maybe plan some more to add to this conversation in the future. If you're over 35, give yourself 2 continuing ed credits in millennial generation study. But if you checked your computer or your cell phone, take away 1 credit.
I'd like to thank everybody who participated, all the panel members.